Welcome to Blacksiders, the no-holds-barred conversation about news and current affairs that we feel like talking about. I'm Peter McGillivray.
And I'm Gemma McKinnon.
Gem, what's happening? What's heap happening?
Hey, I can't believe the year is going so quickly. Can I just say that I barely got used to writing 24 at the end of the date, and then suddenly it's March, and I'm like, what the heckles?
I know. I'm well into work travel now. I had a reprieve for the first couple of months, but now I'm on the road, big Mildura trip, and then a big trip out to Walgett, all squeezed in before the Easter break. It's just storming into April already. Can't even believe it.
And also Easter's really early this year.
Yes.
Which has totally thrown everything off.
Yeah. I mean, we've got a pretty fun social event coming up.
Yeah. And my birthday.
Oh, I forgot about that.
1 year older.
Yeah. 1 year older around the sun. So, Gem, last week we started having a conversation about economic empowerment because, as you explained to us, in Reconciliation Action Plan world, where corporate private Australia is participating in the effort to address Indigenous peoples, you know, disadvantage across most measures, social measures in Australian society, This is their big effort. This is the big way to coordinate at a whole of systems level some kind of change. And you were telling us about a perspective from one of the leaders of the reconciliation effort in corporate Australia that we should be returning to while there's no political appetite for social reform and certainly no political appetite for structural reform, which recognises Indigenous collective rights, politically or otherwise, legally, anything, that economic empowerment is a way forward, something that we can hang our hat on and be working towards together.
That's right. I think, you know, in recognition that maybe the 97% aren't here very actively for reconciliation at the moment, what can we do in lieu of that? And the answer might be this concept of economic empowerment. And I think one of the things that I was thinking about over the week is actually the terminology. So I think we were sort of using economic development and economic empowerment interchangeably, but actually I think the use of economic empowerment as a term is very deliberate, because when we're talking about economic empowerment in this instance, we're not talking about the empowerment of a community to develop their own financial or economic success.
And independence.
What we're talking about is First Nations individuals making a lot of money for themselves, basically. And that's very different, right? It's different, well, on lots of levels, but it's different because it doesn't actually require any outside assistance necessarily. It doesn't require government support. It doesn't require you to sort of be kickstarted in any way. It doesn't require a lot of extra education and training around the space. What it is you as an individual exercising, you know, your own capitalist will.
Yeah.
And that's what I think we need to talk about.
So do you see, in terms of economic empowerment as a way for individual blackfellas to find some type of freedom and mobility in having cash to participate in life, as a short-term solution for all blackfellas, or just a particular cohort of blackfellas?
I've definitely seen people talk about it from the perspective of the success of one blackfella will then lead to success for all blackfellas. And I think there's definitely a school of thought out there that says that, you know, blackfellas are, for example, First Nations business owners are more likely to employ First Nations people, and therefore there's a sort of trickle-down effect from that perspective. But I think the way that we've been talking about it more recently, and in the context that we were talking about it at this conference, that is particularly around having First Nations people on corporate boards as non-executive directors and that sort of approach, sort of hoping that eventually one of those blackfellas is going to be the kind of person that exercises their influence for the better. And just the act of having First Nations people in the room will somehow achieve a broader outcome than just the success of that individual. I'm not sold on that. I think there's been blackfellas around, you know, in boardrooms, in decision-making spaces for a long time, and I don't think that's, you know, made a particular impact on the community more broadly. I also...
Yeah,
can I be like really blunt about it?
Yes, please.
I'm scared. I don't think that the people who are putting all of their energy into, you know, pursuing a career that earns them a whole heap of money are the kind of people that are necessarily going to be choosing that position of power to advocate for other people.
I agree with you, because I think that there are very few wealthy blackfellas who are doing much charity work or doing much contribution to giving back in recognition that, you know, yeah, they've worked really hard, but they have to contribute something, because that's one of the burdens of being the first, one of the first of the first, right? You have to give back. And if that is happening by some, you know, quite wealthy public profile individuals, it's invisible to us. I think that it would be, what I would encourage is for those people to make that more visible. Having said that, there are some really, you know, excellent pieces of work that goes on to build community, to build events, to build festivals, to build, you know, sporting events that actually does some of that, you know, wealth distribution in a philanthropic type of way from community. And I think that's a new thing that as a community we have to start doing and talking about. Is how do we ensure that we don't end up with this measure that capitalists have, which is that the value of you and your success is based upon your social mobility, based upon your earning capacity. As if, you know, one extra blackfella who is in middle Australia means that, yep, job done, social disadvantage solved, without keeping an eye on the reality, which is that social inequality is getting worse in this country, and for blackfellas, 10 times worse than anyone else.
Do you think that this idea of economic empowerment, if I'm playing devil's advocate maybe, or you know, not even necessarily devil's advocate, this is something that I've genuinely sort of considered over time. If there's no political will, no social will, if, you know, effectively we're out there on our own trying to address some serious problems, is it, you know, sometimes I sort of feel like maybe the solution does sort of fall to individuals, powerful, wealthy individuals, to do the job that governments won't do.
The problem that I have with that line of thinking and those logics is that it leaves behind so many people that do not get to participate and who are still suffering from the institutional racism, the real disempowerment from which who are not benefiting from, you know, two or three generations of overcoming social barriers in order for that to be a real reality. I think that it's a bit of a trap to think that through economic empowerment, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in their communities are going to have more real power. So if we are establishing independence and community independence through a wealth and asset base, which we have control over, that's going to somehow result in, you know, over two or three generations, an ability to be more self-determined.
So I don't think that that's what people are suggesting will happen.
Okay.
I think what the suggestion is that it's still a Band-Aid, right?
Mm.
None of this is going to fix the structural issue that we have as a nation. That, you know, our constitution, our legal system, our political system was all built for and by white men.
Mm.
And so everything that is built upon that is built with the assumption that we are less than.
Yeah.
I don't think that anybody thinks that the idea of economic empowerment is going to change that, but I think it kind of may create something that looks and feels pretty close to it.
This might be the perfect opportunity to talk about my lived experience in this context. In the context of, you know, policies and, you know, social policies which benefited my mum's generation in order to allow our family to be able to not have to worry about the things that we needed to survive and then have more time to do things like make sure my sister and I got to school and that my mum was able to, you know, engage in the school in a way that made sure that we got the school outcomes that we did, that we were able to go to high school and that we had the things that we needed to be able to participate in school and have a good experience of school. And therefore, you know, be ready and interested to do something after school, like participate in the workforce and, in my case, go to uni. So I think those are real and tangible examples of areas of life, family life, community life, that if, like, I see that as being part of economic empowerment if we're talking about it in its broadest terms. But I don't know how. Like, if that's what we're talking about, then that makes sense to me. If it's the entrepreneurial piece, that also makes sense to me in terms of, you know, making, scaling the information and the ways that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people can take their incredibly good ideas that lots of people have about how they can, you know, provide services in their community, build businesses in their community, and actually be more self-sustaining so that there's less reliance upon others, outsiders, to have to provide those things. That's a massive opportunity, which if we were talking about economic empowerment in those terms, that makes sense to me. But the individualized approach, the kind of retail politics, Australian political values approach to, you know, emancipation comes in building personal wealth. Maybe that's just my political stripes showing. I don't know. But my understanding of, you know, this idea of economic empowerment has to have a communal community element to it. Otherwise, it just isn't implementable.
And perhaps that's, and I'm just spitballing here, so please don't write in and say, Gemma, they've already done that. Or maybe do write in, but as long as it's constructive. Perhaps it's because we haven't approached this model from that perspective yet.
Mm.
Maybe it's because the people that have been talking about this and championing this as a model for essentially reconciliation far down the track have been looking at it from the perspective of, you know, growing individual wealth and the trickle-down effects that happen for that person's particular family, let's say. But maybe if we do start talking about it as a community from that community development aspect of things, then maybe people will approach it with a different sense of responsibility. You know, yes. maybe those people who, you know, say go to law school, go to business school and contemplate going and working in, you know, in a big multinational corporation, have the capacity to do that and to build that wealth, but don't necessarily get a sense of job satisfaction out of it because they're not, through doing that work, directly giving back to community. Potentially, if we started talking about it as a broader approach and something with which we give people a level of responsibility or expectations, that then you could approach you building your individual wealth as being something greater than you, because then you actually also have this outside responsibility with which to pass it on or whatever it is, share that wealth in some way.
Well, this is where, for me, it's absolutely necessary. I agree with you on all of that. And it has to start within community because, you know, I think there's this idea that financially successful people, wealthy individuals, you know, they go on and they go to university and then they get an MBA and that's the pathway to kind of accruing massive individual wealth. But I actually think that it's much smaller scale than that. Like in community, being supported to be able to start a business that your community needs is probably going without right now because maybe you live regionally or remotely and you don't have an electrician or you don't have a carpenter. So, you know, there's works that need to be done all the way through town, but you don't have anybody to do them. There's government contracts to do that work, but there's nobody available. I mean, these are the really practical kind of small business ideas. Running a food truck or running a community dinner service or whatever it might be, a service to be able to help get lunches ready for elders. Who knows? Could be anything. But these are the types of initiatives and I suppose what I kind of see is...
I mean, I think though, like they're definitely not talking about that when they talk... when people are talking about it, they're definitely not talking about that, right? Which is disappointing. And I think also, I think when you mentioned you have to sort of, it has to start with community, where I thought you were going, which I thought it was a really good, not that your point was great, and I totally agree, but also when it starts with community, maybe we'll get less of, oh, Mr. Big Shot who went to the city and makes heaps of money thinks is too good for us, like less of that. And more, oh, good, education and leaving the community to go and, you know, build that wealth is then sort of celebrated because there is this expectation or knowledge that then somehow that wealth is going to be shared.
Yes.
Rather than sort of built for your own use.
Yeah. I mean, one of the other things is that I think economic empowerment doesn't have to be, and this goes back to the point that you made at the beginning of the yarn, which is understanding it more broadly than just the individual and the the family unit where money comes into the household and it being just within that one household, and the reality being that, you know, in our families, income coming into the family could be being spread across upwards of half a dozen families, and that's how. And so there being some recognition that, you know, what economic models are adapted for our community's purposes, you know, will develop. And so what does economic empowerment look like in that context, as opposed to trying to map, you know, mainstream Australian economic models onto Indigenous people and communities and families. And I think that that actually explains the inability to do that work, explains, I think, the gap between blackfellas who are now firmly in that bracket of income earners that's above moderate and all of the other blackfellas that are still living below the poverty line. I think the leaving it to governments to decide what the financial status of blackfellas is what, you know, and I'll definitely get people writing into me about that, I'm sure. But I don't think we'll do part three. But this idea of money is just such a huge, huge one to cover.
Do you think that we are potentially not naive, but maybe not necessarily plugged in to, you know, the political strategist sort of world? Do you think that some people maybe are thinking, if you become a, you know, a member of the board of a large bank or a resources company or a big tech company, for example, that then you are gaining more than just individual wealth, but you're also gaining power? And that then if we have more people delving into this world of power, that then we'll have more blackfellas in parliament, more blackfellas in lobby groups that actually call the shots behind the scenes in the political space. Is it possible that the people who advocate for this economic empowerment model are people who just know more about how decisions get made, and that we're, yeah, I guess, missing the potential there for having powerful blackfellas around and the impact that they, or influence that they could have then on public and social policy?
No, because the only way that blackfellas with power do anything good with it is if they're held accountable by other blackfellas. And I don't see a lot of that. I don't see a lot of, like, I don't witness anybody using any real power in a way that's changing anything. Because, like, there are powerful blackfellas, individuals.
Yeah.
So where is, I guess I don't see evidence of that.
Pete, I don't see it either. But maybe.
I know, I'm being a bit of a downer, aren't I?
Maybe you're being a realist.
I mean, I
don't say we didn't consider the option at all.
I think I am, you know, I'm a legal pragmatist. I do think that I'm a bit of a political realist, and I think that the only power that really matters is political power, the hard kind.
Okay, let me put this to you. Do you think it's possible that in 50 years' time we could be in a situation where we have black power brokers within our system, let's call it, that are advocating positively on behalf of the First Nations community?
On what grounds? As in they're holding the interests of blackfellas and no one else?
No, but just advocating for positive. So the thing that I have seen is that politicians gain their confidence from having power brokers that back them and support their decisions. So that if we had power brokers that are supportive of positive social or legislative reform that benefits First Nations communities, that that could then in the long run be positive for the community more broadly?
Definitely. Okay, so, all right, let's backtrack a bit. Is the question, well, you know that I've said this before, that I think that the real game to be played going forward is Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in mainstream politics.
Yeah.
That is where, that's the field of play, and us not being on the field is a huge problem. And so that's going to be a focus going forward into the future, absolutely. And you can see in the last 10, 15 years how we are getting more players on the field, and that's great. That needs to happen at every level of government. And the power brokers, I think, will sit in different arenas of community life and in, you know, the broader community, capital C, as well. So you'll have the CEOs of, you know, Aboriginal community-controlled organisations, which are basically, you know, civic organisations or civil society organisations. You'll have Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who are individually high asset net worth individuals, and they will be influential, and they'll be accessing, you know, people, politicians, leaders, and kind of giving their influence and sharing their understanding of their work and worlds. And increasingly, more and more of those people will be Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people instead of non-Indigenous people who often give their opinions about us and our communities and what we need and what we should have. So I think we will benefit from having more and more Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islander people doing that, and that will be hugely impactful, and it'll become like a compounding. So to go back to the original question, actions, policies, tangible things that can be done through the Reconciliation Action Plan effort that help to achieve that outcome would have, I believe, a positive impact. But there, I think that it would be happening at a different level to all of the effort that's also being led by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people that do not see that as the theory of change. Like, they do not buy into the idea that there is anything positive that comes from playing a mainstream game.
So perhaps in the same sort of vein that I took in my comments to the air quotes progressive nose during the referendum campaign, perhaps the solution for those of us who still believe in community-based solutions is to not get in the way of the economic empowerists, because at the end of the day, we may be fighting for the same outcome.
We absolutely are. And I would say that the economic empowerists, I think that there are plenty of progressive no's that are economic empowerists, and this might absolutely get me cancelled. I think that they are in deep denial about their very individualistic perspectives, perhaps.
See you in Siberia.
I mean, there are always deep contradictions in some of these positions, Gemma. You know that we've talked about this before. And the role of economics, there is nothing more deeply contradictory than having a self-reflection about, you know, your economic position in life.
Tact.
You are listening to Blacksiders. This is our No Holds Barred, and we have really gone there in this.
Nothing was held.
Nothing was held back. We dropped some truth bombs, certainly dropped the mic a couple of times, but it is such an important conversation, and I think we just want to, you know, traverse. This won't be the last time that we talk about matters of economics. One of the things that we did want to talk about eventually on Blacksiders is intergenerational wealth. And this,
or our lack of it,
but, you know, potentially not into the future. Not my offspring, but certainly yours could be inheriting A few chickens?
A chicken coop? Yeah, I think so. Yeah. A couple of chickens at least.
Bit of dirt.
That'll start them off.
Big conversation, but we've got through a bit. So, Jem, this week's thumbs up, thumbs down. What is your thumbs down for tonight?
My thumbs down, and I'm going to, this is relevant to our conversation, and to be fair, I don't see it as much these days, but my thumbs down is what I used to call Twitter begging. So people, and particularly, look, I'm going to say blackfellas because just not that white people don't do it, but just that I'm like, oh, so such a shame job when I see blackfellas doing it. Because they're always like well-educated, like well-to-do kind of blackfellas on Twitter crowdfunding for the most ridiculous thing, like crowdfunding for a trip overseas or crowdfunding because they, you know, need, like, air quotes, need a new car or something.
My favorite was some dental work. Invisalign?
Some grills.
Yeah.
And sort of asking their white, let's face it, white followers to donate money to them for things that they, but it was sort of, you know, it's sort of framed in this way of like, this is something that I'm giving you the opportunity to do for me, white people. I'm thumbs downing it because I just find it so cringy. And it's one of those things where it's like, you know, it's like the difference between the eastern suburbs girls doing cocaine in the bathroom and then them sort of looking down on the drug addicts on the street, like as though they're somehow better than
they're exempt from. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, oh, if I'm doing it via a GoFundMe page and I'm talking to, you know, white academics and asking them to give me the money, then it's fine. Like I'm so much better than everybody else. But that's my thumbs down. Shame job. Shame job.
Shame job. My thumbs down is the everyone talking about the cost of living crisis as if that's the only thing that we should really be caring about right now. And I know that that's might be a bit hypocritical because we talked about the cost of living crisis.
And I do complain about it a lot.
Yeah. And look, I think that's fine. Get it off your chest. But the preoccupation with it for political ends is just really tiring at this point. And I think it's being used as cover and distraction for both the federal government and the opposition to not engage meaningfully on anything else. And I don't mean bullshit border security stuff that the opposition wants to dog whistle to racists on. That's not what I'm talking about either. I'm talking about, do cost of living stuff, but do it meaningfully. I'm talking to you, mainstream media. Like the around the grounds, tell us your story about how broke you are. Yeah, thumbs down.
How much does a box of rice bubbles cost here? That sort of.
Yeah, and kind of the blur, like the special interest stories about, you know, different costs of different products. I just, I'm not into it. Thumbs down.
Boo.
What's your thumbs up for this week?
Thumbs up for me is the, this is a really, I always seem to come up with these ones straight after we've talked about like the cost of living crisis and that there's like more to life. But I'm going to thumbs up that you, oh my God, I'm embarrassed, but I'm going to push ahead.
Yeah.
I'm thumbs up that you can now buy coffee beans in the supermarket that have the like resealable like zip seal thing, because for so long you could only buy coffee beans in like either 500 gram or what, like big bags, and they were not resealable, and so I'd have to find a container or whatever, but there's no freshness, whereas now... I'm sorry. I know.
Don't apologize.
I know.
For this. You're allowed to.
But I basically only buy beans that have a Ziploc on it now.
Smart. I mean, there is not a lot to be finding joy in life at the moment. So finding joy in fresh coffee beans for your morning brew is, I applaud that, thumbs up.
I just like generally packaging that is thoughtful.
Functional.
Maybe I should have said that. Thoughtful packaging. Thumbs up. Because sometimes there's too much unnecessary plastic. That annoys me too, but that's one way to get your customers. That's all I'm saying.
Well, my thumbs up is actually addressing a question that we didn't get to talk about, which was, if you were rich, what would you do to change the future for Mob? And there are some people who are already doing this because they're rich. In the New South Wales Koori Knockout Football Carnival, being able to pay your players to play in the Koori Knockout.
Damn.
That is a big thumbs up to that. I think that if you know, out there earning big bucks through your entrepreneurial spirit and hard work, I sound like a total neocon. I'm not, but I'm just applying it to this thumbs up this week. Then good on you. If you can pay for players to play and then win the tournament, hallelujah to you. I think that's great.
But what does that – I won't even go there. But, like, then what about the poor little communities that don't have rich members of the community? But I guess they'll still play, won't they?
Of course they will. And this just supports the theory that I have that you can bring all of our economic and political conundrums to the metaphor of a rugby league game. You know, where you can, or a rugby league football carnival. But we'll pick that up another time. Jem, we are all out of time tonight.
Two-parter. I'm quite liking it. Beware, yeah. Beware, audience. You may have to suffer through the week of contemplation again.
Yeah, I love it, though. I love just being able to, you know, knock about with you and see what we can work through in our minds. I mean, please get in touch with us if you've got views and thoughts, because we want our community correspondents weighing in on this one. It's a big one. And as we go, our thoughts may change and we'll be open to that, you know, especially going and reading and hearing new ideas and things that are relevant to this discussion, for sure. Well, see you later, Jem. Have a good week.
See you. Buy local and buy First Nations owned.
Yeah, buy black. Hashtag buy black. Good night.